John O'Brien recording an interview with Dr. Leon Wiltsey, the 20th of May 1987 at 149 Harley Street. Lee, you were born in the Western States, weren't you?
Yes, I was born in North Dakota. As you know, it's right on the Canadian border, and I was actually born in the southeastern portion, but North Dakota is the absolute center of North America. There's a little monument there showing the center of North America.
I see. Were your parents medical at all?
No. My family were ranchers. My family raised cattle, basically, and on one occasion raised sheep.
I see.
We were cowboys in a way. We rode horses mostly.
Well, North Dakota was really frontier, wasn't it?
North Dakota was a frontier. It's probably almost as much frontier today as any part of North America.
Yes. Where were your parents from, Lee?
They initially came to America before the American Revolution, and they had moved west gradually, and had my father and mother had come to North Dakota in a covered wagon, one of those wagons pulled by oxen.
Go on. Where did they come from? Where did they come from in the States?
They came from Iowa, which is east of there, of course.
Sure. Yeah. And your early schooling was in North Dakota, wasn't it?
My early schooling was in North Dakota. Mm. I went to a typical country school, and where we had one teacher for a large room full of children. And we rode horseback to school 4 miles. It was real, real ranching country in primitive America.
You're part of the American roots scene, I would say.
I am part of the American roots.
And tell me, when did you, your secondary schooling was in North Dakota?
Yes, I suppose we called it high school. It was right there in North Dakota. And then on to college, I taught school. During the Great Depression, I ran a little low on money, so I got a job teaching school for 2 years. And then on to the University of North Dakota, and from University of North Dakota on to Northwestern University, which is in Chicago.
Which is where you graduated in medicine.
That's where I got my medicine.
Fine. Now, you must have had rather stark memories of the Depression years.
The Depression years were everything that they were said to be. They influenced a whole generation. To this day, I can't, shall we say, throw money around.
Mm. And do you have any nostalgia for North Dakota? Do you ever return there, or?
I have great nostalgia for North Dakota, and we do return at least once a year.
Yes.
Yeah.
Did you leave during the Depression?
I left in 1936 and went off to Chicago. Now, the Depression was getting over by 1936. The Great Depression hit its nadir in 33. Started in 1929, the Great Wall Street Crash, when everyone was jumping out of windows. And it hit its nadir in 33 when Roosevelt closed the banks. All of the banks closed in the United States for a long weekend. And then a few of them opened up on Monday morning.
Go on. I remember you saying once you left in some terrible sandstorm. Is that correct?
In 1933, the day the banks closed, there was a sandstorm. See, not only was there a depression, but the area turned into a dust bowl.
Mm.
And on the day the bank closed, you couldn't see the sun because of dust in the air. And I said to myself, this is no place. I'm getting out of here.
Yes. So, Lee, you went on to medical school at Northwestern in Chicago.
Yes.
What year did you start?
Well, now, I had 2 years of medical school at the University of North Dakota. The University of North Dakota has has had a medical school for a long time, maybe 60, 70 years, but always a two-year school. They could give you the basics, anatomy and all of the basic sciences. Then you went on to Northwestern or Rush. Rush was a famous old school. So I'd say that half the doctors of the Middle West had 2 years at their native state university, then off to the, we call it the big school or wherever,
yeah.
Harvard, Pennsylvania, Northwestern, were the ones that took most of our men.
Yes. Was it difficult to get into medical school in those days?
Yes, it was. It was not as difficult as it became, say, 5 years ago. 5 years ago, right across the board, there were 15 and 20 applicants for a place. But when I came along, it was probably almost exactly like it is now. It's still fairly difficult, but but getting into medical school is very much easier now than it was 5 years ago.
I see. And when did you get any, who was it that sowed the seed of medicine in your brain?
Well, we had a fine country practitioner who my mother was very fond of, and she was one, I suppose. She with him as a model.
Hmm. Uh-huh. And so, what year did you graduate, Lee?
Graduated in 1940.
So you were coming up to the war years?
Yes.
So did you have a good war?
Yes. Now, I went off to a charity hospital in New Orleans for my internship. North Dakota was culturally as different from New Orleans as Los Angeles is from the capital of Afghanistan.
I'm sure.
And I thought to myself, I would like to see a different part of the country. And my master plan was to take my internship. In those days, we all took an intern at New Orleans, and then my plan was to go on up to New York for we call it residency. However, I never got to New York because the war came along and we were frozen in our position.
Yes.
My family, as I said, were rather big ranchers, but pretty much I was on my own financially.
Sure.
Of course, by then, the country came back. North Dakota came back economically rather rapidly.
During the war?
Before the war. By the time the war came along,
yeah.
North Dakota had returned economically to...
Actually, that's interesting because the states in 39, the states were still in a very tough squeeze, wasn't it?
Yes, they were, but I think North Dakota did a bit better than a lot of them. They lost half their population. They just got in their car and went west. So anyone who didn't have a reasonably good ranch or farm took off.
Yes.
You know? Went to work in the sawmills of Oregon.
What about these dreadful storms and the Steinbeck sort of years there? How long did that last, the terrible sort of
dust
bowl?
It ended in about 35.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And has there been anything like it before or since?
Nothing like it.
No.
No.
So was that, I've always been intrigued with the Depression and the just how horrible it was. Was it just a fluke combination of terrible economic times with most amazing weather conditions?
That was what made it so bad, was the combination of the farmers and ranchers had come in there and they had over-farmed the area. They didn't realize that it was dry country. They apparently had a number of years, things go in cycles, and there was rain. So all of a sudden, Mother Nature decided to cut off the rain.
Mm.
So you had a combination. Now, other parts of everywhere in the United States was tough. Detroit was very bad. But California, on the other hand, hardly suffered from
yes.
the Depression.
Yes.
I don't know why. I think they were getting they had things going for them. They had shipping and they had other things.
Yes, sure. Yes. More diverse economy.
Yes.
So, did you spend any of the war years overseas at all?
No, I never got overseas. I was on full duty and ready to go and was ordered out on about three occasions, but I had just about finished my residency, and my professor of orthopedics had gone to Walter Reed, which you know is the Army Medical Center.
Yes.
And he wrote to me and said, we have the prerogative of choosing someone to come and work with us here. Would you like to come? And I said, I would like to come. I knew I had to come to war. And I had just gotten married, and I was not anxious to leave my wife.
Sure.
And Dorothy. So I went to Walter Reed, and I fought the war at Walter Reed.
I see.
Stayed right there.
Who was the professor of orthopedics you mentioned at Walter
Reed? A man named Aldrich. He still lives in New Orleans, and he's not professor anymore, but no. He lives there.
Yes. So, where did you have your orthopedic training?
Well, I got it before the war.
In New Orleans?
In New Orleans, yes.
And in New York?
I never got to New York, but Walter Reed was an approved residency.
I see.
See, it was the only... There were two approved residencies in the U.S. Army. There may have been others, but I know of two. Walter Reed was the major one. And then I think Letterman had an approved residency. And perhaps Fitzsimmons. I'm not sure about that.
I see.
Yeah.
Now, what was the stimulus that attracted you to orthopedic surgery? Was there any particular one of your teachers who guided you that way? Why didn't you do medicine or general surgery, for example?
I was born a carpenter. I loved carpentry, and from the day I was old enough to pick up a hammer or make things, drilling holes, seemed to be adept with my hands, and it was a natural for me.
I see.
Yeah.
Now, for many, many years, and I think still you practice general orthopedics, don't you?
No, yes. For many, many years I did, but I haven't, I still do an occasional total hip on my old patients, but beyond that, my practice starts at about T10 and ends at the coccyx.
I see.
Although I haven't done a coccygectomy in 10 years.
I see. Now, when did you acquire your interest in, a particular interest in spines?
That was because I was so inundated with spines. The Crippled Children's work in Los Angeles and everywhere in America is almost totally dominated by the big children's hospitals. So that took most of the children's work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Off. The scoliosis is totally dominated by places like Rancho and the Shriners Hospital. And the big university setups. So we were left with the fractures and the general orthopedics. And as you know, spine was the problem. Everybody recognized the lumbar spine as the problem, and nobody knew what to do with it. And by sheer force of numbers, I decided, well, if I can't beat them, I'll join them. So I became a lumbar spine surgeon.
Right.
Decided it intrigued me. There, I thought there's got has to be something more that can be done for this lower back.
It's surprising looking back just how difficult it is to recruit young men into the field of the spine. Would you agree?
It seems to be. I was at the university hospital there at University of California at Irvine along with a man named Hall. And we just had innumerable hips. And I said to Richard Hall, I said, no, we must make something of this opportunity here. We just have these patients, and we have innumerable spines and innumerable hips. Which do you want? He said, there's no question which I want. I won't have those spines.
Yeah, sure.
So by exclusion,
really, you got the spines.
I got the spines. I might have made well with the hips because we were replacing, or we were using methylmethacrylate quite early. You may not know it, but I was putting prosthesis in and bonding it in with methylmethacrylate in 1950.
Go on. You were one, must have been one of the pioneers.
Yes, I think probably was.
Where did you get that idea?
My brother-in-law was a dentist.
Ah, yes.
And he came back from the war, and we were sitting over a cocktail, and he said, you know, it's come out of Germany, although nobody knew it until the war had to get over, that they've figured out a way to take the ingredients of leucite, which was methylmethacrylate.
Leucite?
Leucite is a DuPont product.
Ah, yes.
And they said that you can take the ingredients, and by adding a little catalyst, you can stir it up and it will set hard. And we're using it in teeth. We're for filling large numbers of teeth among people who don't have too much money. You can fill it with this stuff and it lasts pretty well.
Go on. And this is used for bonding in the binding the teeth in, cementing the teeth in, or what?
No, they fill it. The filling.
Oh, as a filler, sure, I see.
Yes.
And it was successful in dentistry for filling.
Only moderately, but it was. That's how I got my idea. So I had lots of monkeys. We were at that at a big VA hospital, and they were doing polio research. And once a monkey had been injected with whatever it was they were doing, trying to do polio research, he was useless anymore, and they were killing them. So all of a sudden we had all the monkeys we could use, and I was making artificial joints and bonding it in with this methylmethacrylate, with this stuff that came out of, that they said came out of Germany.
What was the use the Germans put this material to during the war?
I don't know how they were doing it, but you remember, they were very advanced in chemistry before the war.
Sure, yes, of course.
Yeah.
Well, that's very interesting. Did you ever publish that work on the monkey research?
Yes, it was published. We published it first in 1953. It's in a short, and then I have a long article in 1957 on it.
That's fascinating. Yes. Now, were you ever influenced by, or did you ever know Hibbs, Russell Hibbs in New York?
No, I knew of him a great deal. And I never actually saw him. I've forgotten what year he died, but if he wasn't, I believe he was dead before I came along.
Oh, I see. Well, his junior partner, Joe Rissi, you would have been.
I knew him very well for years. I've been at his house, and he's been at mine.
Yes, we were impressed with his contribution.
Yes, yes. Risser was certainly a great man. He was, his contributions to scoliosis were enormous. He, of course, made, if you call it a mistake, he was very slow to accept internal fixation.
Mm.
His own son-in-law was working on internal fixation, and I don't think he dared tell his father-in-law.
Yes, that's right. Thank you. Yes, yes.
That may be just scuttlebutt, but yeah, I've heard it said.
I think it's true. And, yes, I see, you never were involved with deformity work yourself in the spine.
No, not extensively. Well, no. I've been involved in the last 20 years, but that's in the elderly, the collapsing, deformed spine of the elderly.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes. Well, I think you take the prize for traveling and writing in American orthopedic surgery, and certainly in American spinal surgery. Where did you get the interest in traveling?
America, as a private practitioner, and especially in a fairly good town, a person could make enough money so that he could take off and travel. We probably went through the good years in America, I'm not sure. But it's been said you could make enough money a third of your time so that the rest of the time you could spend it traveling or teaching or whatever you wanted to do. A lot of people spend a lot of time teaching, and I did too, but I didn't spend anywhere near the amount of time that some of my colleagues did. Some of them were teaching at their university 2 full days a week.
Mm.
Actually, I did two half-days a week for many, many years.
At the University of Southern California?
It's called the University of California, the Irvine Division.
Yes.
That's because it's close to my home.
Yes, sure. Now, just getting back, you were mentioning the monkeys and the polio research. You must have had a huge experience with the polio epidemics yourself.
Yes, I did. There were times we would have wards full of polio. We could have as many as 50 polio children at one time.
You're on the staff at Rancho, aren't you, where so much polio work was done?
Yes, I was on the staff. I didn't actually do a lot of polio work there, but I did some.
You knew Jackie Perry and Vern Nickel?
Very well.
Yes, indeed. Were you ever... how involved were you in the development of techniques for polio reconstruction?
Not to speak of. I can't take credit for anything in polio. But of course it stopped abruptly in, I forget what year.
Fine. What about tuberculosis, Lee? Did you ever see much TB in your time?
As a resident, I saw a lot. We had a hospital full of it
in New Chicago, Orleans. In New Orleans?
Yes.
Was this all local TB, wasn't it?
Charity Hospital was New Orleans. It was Louisiana's big hospital, biggest hospital in the world at that moment.
Mm.
In one big, beautiful new tower, they had 3,300 beds, which was, it's not a lot if you consider sprawling hospitals where they have two or three campuses, but for one big tower, it was a lot.
Mm.
And we were right there in that one hospital. We lived there, slept there, ate there.
Mm. There's total commitment.
Yes.
Yes. You've practiced all your life in California, have you?
No, I went, of course, the war. War got over, I went down to Dallas. I associated myself with a professor of orthopedics there at Dallas.
Who was that?
His name was Gerard.
Mm-hmm.
Gerard was, and I was with him for about a year and a half, and then went on out to Long Beach.
What year did you reach Long Beach?
48.
Mm-hmm. I see. Now, when did you start with your major interest in spinal work?
I wrote on a summer day in 1950. I was sitting in my office, and a man brought his daughter in to see me, and she had a spinal ischiasis with about 100% slip. So here was this girl. I'll have to back up. It was his son. Son had 100% slip, and I took one look at him, and we X-rayed him, and I said, "Well, he's got spondylolisthesis, and how much trouble he's having? Well, he's having a lot. He can't even bend over to touch his knees. His hamstrings were so tight." Now that was 1950. So I looked at him a while, looked at the boy, and I said, "Well, I believe a spinal fusion would do well." And the man said, "Would you have a look at Bonnie? She's out in the waiting room." So they brought Bonnie in, and Bonnie looked exactly like the boy. We X-rayed her, and she had spondylolisthesis with about 60 or 80% slip, which is high. And the prevailing theory was that spondylolisthesis was a birth fracture. A man named Hitchcock wrote a thesis on it and got his membership in the AOA. Those days you had to produce something new to be a member of the American Orthopedic.
Right, yes.
And that it was all a birth fracture, that they hyperextended the child as they delivered the baby and broke the pars. And I said to myself, two in a family with a birth fracture? I said, how many, have you got any other children at home? Yes, we have four more. I said, well, if we would X-ray them free, would you bring them in? Yes. Three of the four had spondylolisthesis. And the one that didn't have it was a baby. I didn't know it at the time, but babies don't have pars fractures to speak of.
Mm.
There's been a case on record or something like that. So I immediately said, well, this is something new and different in the world. So I start, every time a child would come in with spondylolisthesis, I would immediately x-ray all of their family and siblings, grandpas, uncles, aunts. And those days, no one was afraid of x-rays, so they'd bring them in, a free x-ray. And I wrote an article in about a year or two, finally hit the Journal of Bone Joint Surgery. Basically, if you have spondylolisthesis, your chances of your near relatives having it were 26%, which is far above what it ought to be.
Were you actually involved with that Alaskan study of Stewart's?
No, but I knew him very well. I went to...
Could you just mention the background of that study? Because it's occasionally referred to.
Dale Stewart was a curator of the Department of Physical Anthropology at the Smithsonian Institute. And as such, he got interested in Eskimos. Everyone has to have an interest if you're going to be a professor and PhD and an anthropologist. And his was Eskimos. And he would go up there every summer and spend time at Point Barrow. And the Eskimos didn't bury their dead underground. They buried them out on a little box. They would get wood from somewhere and make a box on top. Well, in the summer, the snow would melt. And he would be living there in Point Barrow, and he would go out, and the sun never went down, so he'd have to go out at late at night, and he didn't stand up, but he would pry the lid off, it was practically push it off, and he'd feel around until he found the spinal bones. Then he'd put them in the bag and take them home. Mm-hmm. And he got thousands of these. Then he started looking, and he realized that those Eskimos at Point Barrow, that 67% of them had spondylolisthesis. So he was onto something. So he went to others, and that was his life work as far as his new contributions. And meantime, he was curator of the Department of Physical Anthropology at Smithsonian Institute. But he was all over Alaska, and for instance, the Eskimos down near Juneau, their incidence would be like 20%. But in the isolated villages where they had lived for centuries and been intermarrying for centuries, it hit a top of 67%.
I've noticed, I've seen that collection. It's in the Smithsonian, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yes, I've seen it on display. I didn't realize he was actually one of the staff.
Yes.
Sure. He was medically trained, wasn't
Doctor
he?
Doctor
of
medicine, yes.
So you've been writing about spinal work for the last 37 odd years?
Yes.
Yes. What would you say was your greatest contribution, Lee?
I think probably my spondylolisthesis work was the greatest contribution, because and the other thing was that it is a stress fracture. I think that was a contribution of mine, that it is a stress fracture. I called it fatigue fracture. That was what we called it.
So, sure, yes.
Until then, we didn't know that athletes, if the super athletes fatigue their cars and break it. We didn't know that at all. Mm. I got onto it. The pole vaulters at State University, Long Beach State University, had a good pole vault team. Then I got two of these young boys in with backache, and I x-rayed them, and both of them had the beginning of pars fractures, barely visible. And while I was observing them over the next 6 months, lo and behold, it became very visible. And I said to myself, this is a fatigue fracture that these people are getting.
Yes. What other sports are the risk sports regarding spondylolisthesis?
The pitchers, these little pitchers, we have the Little League in America, and these little boys start when they're 11 years old, and with all their parents and grandparents sitting in the stands cheering them on, they will pitch till they can hardly walk.
What part of the pitch do they injure their back with? Is it a twisting injury?
Leaning back and twisting,
I believe.
Leaning back. The other one is the batsman in, is that cricket? Do they have the batsman?
I think it's the bowlers. It's the pitchers.
Oh, the bowler.
The bowler or the pitchers. The pitchers or the bowlers in cricket, they get lytic lesions in the spot. They get spondylolysis.
The other one, of course, are the gymnasts. Gymnasts have a lot of it. And who else? But the baseball pitchers. The little league pitchers.
Yes.
And the football players. That's the other one. These little, see, we had the, what we call Pappy Waldorf football, where little boys were out there playing, and they would play till they got so bad off, their back was hurting so bad they couldn't make it anymore. And then you would x-ray them, and you might get nothing. Since then, when the little boy comes in, and I say, are you playing very hard some game? Oh, yes. Get a bone scan and it's hot.
Whereas the x-ray would be normal.
Still negative.
Yes.
But if they keep on their sport, it will break.
You'll see it on the x-ray then.
Eventually, in a week or two.
By the way, how do you treat them when the scan is hot and the x-ray is normal?
If the x-ray is normal and the scan is hot, take them off their athletics, and I put them in a heavy corset, not a brace, just a heavy corset. They will heal every time.
Over what period, Lee?
You better keep them off their sport for at least 6 months.
Mm. That's very interesting.
But once it's established, if you have one side still intact and the other side fractured, take them off their sports, put them in a corset, and they will heal every time. But once you've got both sides broken, then they may or may not heal.
I see. Now, you've been to Hong Kong. I seem to remember, I did actually meet you there in about 1968, my first year there. I'd be interested in your general comments about anterior spinal surgery.
I assisted in my first anterior spinal surgery in 1940. I was an intern. I pulled on a retractor, and he drove a...
Who was the surgeon?
A man named Pennock. He was a general surgeon.
P-E-N-N-E-C-K. Pennock, yes. Where was this, Lee?
New Orleans.
Yeah.
Charity, New Orleans. He was the general surgeon who opened the abdomen, and a resident named Fred Stuttle took a graft out of the tibia with an Albee saw, the old Albee saw, and drove it across.
Across the lumbar sacral joint.
From L5 to S1.
Yes.
And I said to myself, this cannot possibly do anything but heal. Actually, it didn't heal.
Did they remove the disc?
They did not. They just drilled a big hole, but it was a big hole they drilled. But he broke it. I think the boy did not take very good care of it, and he got up and broke the graft. So then we started doing the Mercer type, you know, the Walter Mercer of Edinburgh.
Yes.
But we didn't do them in high-grade spondies. You could only do that in a low-grade spondy or some other type. None of them healed, not one. So I said to myself, this is a useless operation.
This was in the 40s or 50s now?
40s, early 40s. So none of our inner bodies would fuse. They simply wouldn't fuse. And then Frank Rainey of San Francisco said, well, I've got a method that'll fuse. And if you don't believe me, you come up to San Francisco and I'll show you. And I went up to San Francisco, and lo and behold, they were fusing. And the way he did it was to clean out the disc space very thoroughly, leave the end plate very carefully, but take off a shaving, and then put a block of ilium, way back against the posterior longitudinal ligament, and then he would put three or four struts of tibia, or fibula, very tightly in front. You would spread it very hard and take these segments of fibula, which he cut with a motor saw, and put them in there. And they were healing. And I said, "Eureka, I now know how to get an anterior in a body fusion." So I did that for the next 10 years.
You must have had some opposition from your colleagues.
Yes, but not much. Long Beach is a very nice town. Nobody...
I didn't mean specifically Long Beach. I mean, anterior surgery's always had a hard time, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. Well, then I discovered that you didn't need that ileum in there. You could use all fibula. That way you save one approach, because taking a piece out of the ileum is traumatic. So just the fibula alone. And I have used fibula alone for the last 20 years. And really, the results are very good. I know of one failure, but I don't know of others. I've offered my fellows $1,000 if they'll show me a
show
case.
You a non-union.
A non-union.
With fibula autograft.
Yes.
In anterior fusion for spondylolisthesis.
Not spondy, for other reasons.
Oh, I see. For discogenic pain, yes.
And the other thing is, it has to stand, if you put them in badly, and if they tip over, they never unite. If your grafts tip over, they virtually don't unite.
Right.
That's number one. I always have to qualify. I say, no, spondies don't do well because there's only such a small area left and they slip 50%.
They're mechanically so unstable, aren't they?
Yeah.
Would you say a few words about discography and your feelings about it, Lee?
I did my first discogram in 1953. Lindblom had described it in 47 or 8. And we were using fluoroscope, but we had to use x-ray mostly because the fluoro was not very good in 1953. And I've always liked it. It adds something. I use it in particular for above a contemplated fusion. I'm going to do an L5-S1 fusion for spondy, and I'm wondering about L4. If L4, it may look degenerated, but if it isn't painful, then I feel secure in doing a one-level fusion, and I've done way more one-level fusions than two-level in spondy.
And for choice, you would use the lateral approach for that rather than anterior?
I use the paraspinous approach.
Yes. Which do you think has the most certain results in your hands, the anterior fusion or the lateral fusion?
The lateral.
Why do you think that is?
We're going to present a paper over in Italy on 8 cases of very high-grade slip who all had spondylolisthesis, all had leg pain, most of them had reflex change, and they're all adults past 21 and under 35, and they all healed, got solid 100%. Now, these are not selected, that's the way we did them all. They all got rid of their neurological change, and I told my fellow, you simply can't report 100% excellent results. Some of them must have been good, not excellent. He says, no, they say they're excellent. So the paraspinous approach I like very much. And now I find that Harry Crock has published a paper, or is publishing one, where he spends a lot of time saving the midline structures, but he does not make a paraspinous approach as I've done all these 30 years.
Yes. Yeah. Well, have you been impressed with the work of Cloud in Honolulu?
Cloward is certainly the world's greatest instrument maker. His instruments are always perfect, it seems. Should say one of the world's greatest.
Lee Wilsey being the other.
No.
Come on, Lee.
But his work, I have not been able to duplicate his results with Pliff. And of course, Pliff is what
That's the posterior interbody fusion.
Yes.
Yes.
Posterior lumbar interbody fusion. He reported it the first time that I was aware of in 1954 at at Sun Valley, Idaho. And he showed these results with the PLIF. And all of us ran home and started doing them. We said, this is the greatest thing in the world. We will do PLIFs now. Because we were having trouble. Remember, in 54, we didn't know enough to go out laterally onto the transverse presses. And our failure rate was very high. And so we said to ourselves, well, we will do a PLIF. But we'll do one more thing. We'll do a posterior fusion too, because we're right there. And that'll make our results very good. And it did make it very good, except for one thing. We got quite a bit of trouble from all the pulling around of the nerves. You're talking about when the rank and file starts doing an operation, they get in trouble. And there were at least three or four paraplegics that I know of.
From PLIFs?
From PLIFs.
Good heavens.
Part of the reason was they pulled it too hard. When you cut all the midline structures out, there's nothing to stop you from pulling it too hard, you see. Then on top of that, some of them went up to L3, and they had a transitional L5, and they didn't realize they were up at L2.
Sure. The termination of the cord.
Yes.
Right.
You can't pull that.
Right.
Yes. But I think the PLIF has a place, but frankly, we're going to review PLIF again. I haven't done a PLIF in 4 or 5 years.
Well, it's technically a tough number, isn't it?
Yes.
What are your feelings about, so the future in spinal surgery? Because the past is pretty grim, really. It's been difficult to get people recruited into the subject. It's difficult to get the same response that the, say, heart surgery gets from the community. What do you feel about the future of spinal surgery, Lee?
I'm terribly optimistic. I could easily, if I were to start over again, go into spine surgery. And I might actually go into spinal cord injury. Because I think we've got a long way to go in spinal cord injury.
With what respect? In what particular way? With decompression of the cord, or internal fixing of the spine, or both, or what?
Internal fixation, for one thing. We can internally fixate immediately, and we can do just one level or two levels, whatever needs to be done. We don't have to make great long fixations. We can decompress as necessary. We can tamp the bone forward. There's usually a lump of bone or even a disc anteriorly. We can slip around to the side and pull out the bone anteriorly, which we couldn't do previously. And so we have much better anesthesia, much better general care. The anesthesiologists are much better than they used to be, and we can take people that are quite sick from other injuries, take them to surgery immediately, and decompress immediately. We can go around in front and decompress. We can fix them immediately and fix only one segment or two, whatever needs to be fixed.
You're a great believer in acute surgery in the cord injury.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
But I suppose greater than all, we have the CAT scan and the MR. They tell us exactly what's wrong.
Sure.
We don't have to rely on a myelogram, which was so poor.
Yes. And you were mentioning this morning at breakfast that you've designed your own system of internal fixation. Would you like to say a few words about that?
Yes. I feel very optimistic about it. I don't know that it's the best one ever designed, or certainly not the best one that will be designed.
It's pedicular, is it? A pedicle screw fixation.
Yes, use pedicle screws. And if... let's say, given a crushed T12, one can go in posteriorly, can decompress what's necessary posteriorly, but he can go around anteriorly from the side and take away bone. He can then put in the pedicle screws, and then by a system of manipulation using turnbuckles, and we call them joysticks, they attach to the screws so we can manipulate them around. We can pull them toward the ceiling. If one vertebra slipped forward, we have a mechanism for pulling it toward the ceiling, for spreading it, for tilting it. And then after we have it, as we say, this is perfect, we have the nice fluoroscope that's sitting right there telling us what our situation is. And we say, this is perfect. So now we bend rods to perfection to hold it. The way we do that is with some aluminum rods. We put aluminum rods in and make a model out of these soft aluminum. Take them to a bending apparatus and reproduce them in stainless steel.
Have you used this very often, Lee?
We're up to 150 cases now, but we haven't done much spinal cord injury. Within the last 2 weeks, Rancho has now finally gotten approval from the powers that be, and they have the new set. So I'm hoping that that it can be used very well for the spinal cord injury, because I think that it's got a place there.
What do you use it most commonly for?
Most commonly, it is used for the collapsing spine. We may extend it to others, but let's just say you have a case that... Collapsing scoliosis, yes.
I see.
With spinal stenosis, you can...
This is the degenerative.
Degenerative,
I see.
We're using it on the degenerative, largely.
So you're restoring the height, you're restoring, the correcting the deformity.
We don't correct the deformity at the moment as much as we do, of course, a CAT scan and an MR and maybe a myelogram. We know exactly where the nerves are being pinched. We decompress them where they're being pinched. And, of course, we can go all the way out.
Lee, tell me, do you think your fixation system is an improvement on the other systems available, or is it just another alternative? What are the features of it?
I think it's very secure. We've never had one single rod loosened between the rod screw junctions. It stays totally tight. And we've had two screws break, but that was a mechanical error in a way. It was a pseudarthrosis, but they left the screws in. They thought they'd hold it. And as we know, all pseudos will break. Add to that, there was only one pair of screws in the sacrum and a great long... So it was a five-level fusion with only one set of screws in the sacrum. Everything was done wrong.
It's bound to fail.
Yeah. And so it had only one set of screws break, never a rod loosened. I don't believe any rods are broken. But the major advantage is, no matter how crooked the spine is, you can fix it in situ if you wish, or you can reduce it a little, or you can reduce it a lot. But the minute you start reducing under heavy pressure, the chances are that we're going to have to go anteriorly by some route, either clip, and we mentioned the clip, and one of our colleagues is going way far out laterally and putting in small plugs so that he gets the support without having to spend an hour or so on each level doing the clip.
Right. Let me ask you about the malpractice scene in the States. There's been a lot of discussion over the last few years about the sums of money you have to pay each year for insurance.
Yes.
What's your feeling about it? It seems to be quite hostile,
yes.
A very expensive business, and everyone is alienated by it.
Yes. It is. It's bad, and it's one of those things that it seems almost impossible to do very much about. In the first place, the United States is a country of laws, as of course your country is. But 75% of Sacramento, of what we call our legislature, are lawyers. And some 80% of our Congress are lawyers.
Yeah.
And most of the time our president is a lawyer. Our governor is a lawyer.
They need a few spinal surgeons, you know.
Yes.
Wilkie for president.
But And the problem is that they say, well, here's a person who was clearly injured by surgery, and had he never had the surgery, he may have been a little crooked spine, or he would have had
a little backache.
But now look at him, he's paralyzed, and he has a life expectancy of 50 years, or 30 years, whatever. And to support him in any decent style, and then you get the calculator going, and it comes to $15 million,
yeah.
Which is, of course, true. And so they say he must be compensated to the tune of $15 million. Well, what is the argument against it? It's a difficult problem.
But it's no closer being resolved now than it was 10 years ago in the States.
No closer.
Because the settlements are larger.
And
you're paying more.
And we're paying more.
Yeah.
We haven't solved it, and I don't know whether it will be solved. There was a movement to make doctors immune to malpractice, but very, very subject to control by their peers. If a man did something that was obviously careless or wrong, then he would have to either quit doing that operation or go take some training. It was a complicated series of...
This is a control from within, is it?
Yes, trying to control within, from within.
Yes, I think that's the only way around. You need some accounting, surely.
But, of course, the lawyers immediately say, sure, you fellows, you're not going to control yourselves.
Mm.
Because we don't think the lawyers control themselves very well.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me, Lee, this North American Spine Association that's gathered a lot of momentum in the last couple of years, would you say a few words on that before we wind up?
Yes. It's very good. I don't want to exaggerate. I believe the membership is now up to about 340, and I hear rumors that it may go as high as 700. I wouldn't be surprised. The International Society for the Study of the Lumbar Spine was founded about 12 years ago, and being international, the United States couldn't possibly have more than, let us say, 30 members or 40, whatever it is, out of about 150. Obviously, even that is a lot. So, and at the same time, we have in the United States, I believe, up around 17,000 certified orthopedic surgeons. And so the number of them that would like to be in a spine society was enormous, and the pressure was building, and it was time that we formed a society so they could have a sort of a home. Those who were doing more, if 50% of their work was spine, then they were eligible for a membership. And it's good. I think it's a great advance. And I know everyone says, why one more society? Well, to some of us who belong to a lot of societies, that is important. But the rank and file of orthopedic surgeon doesn't belong to more than three or four societies. There's his local state medical society and his county medical society, and perhaps the AMA and the Academy, or American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, and there it about ends. And if they're very heavily involved with the spine, they need such a society.
Well, I agree. I think the big advantage of the North American Spine Association is that you have the scoliosis people talking with the cervical spine people and with the back pain people, and because these groups have not been exchanging ideas till now.
Well, the North American Spine Society is largely lumbar spine. The Scoliosis Research Society still exists. The what they call Asia, that's the Spinal Cord Injury Society, it exists. And there's the Cervical Spine Research Society. Now we have another thing. It's not a society at all. It's called FOSSA, Federation of Spine Associations. And every year during the Academy, we'll have at least a day, and perhaps later a day and a half, devoted to the Federation of Spine Associations, which I specify as is nothing but a means of putting on a meeting of all four major spine societies where we intermingle.
That's a really good idea. Well, Lee, we've just about used up an hour of tape. I want to thank you very much. I'm delighted that you and Dorothy, your charming wife, have stopped over in London on the way to the lumbar spine meeting in Rome next week. I hope you enjoy your visit to Rome, and I'm delighted and very honored that you've taken the time off from your busy schedule to sit down and chat over old times. So thank you very much, Lee.
It's been my pleasure.